So today I want to talk about something that I discovered only a few weeks ago. Quite honestly, was a surprise to me. And I feel somewhat betrayed by the systems of education. I don't mean public school, I mean just life around. The fact that I made it half a century without ever having heard this. And I don't think I'm unusual in this sense, which is why I want to talk about it today. But I've got a little quiz for you. If I said, what are the ways that humans respond to threat? Raise your hand if you're familiar with fight or flight, right? Everyone knows that. There's two ways people respond to threats, right? Wrong. I discovered a few weeks ago that there are actually four ways that people respond to threats. In all honesty, how many people know the four ways that people respond to threats? I got two hands, three, four. A very small number for those that are, what? I told you guys, yeah, they don't count. We talk about this stuff. In all fairness, the vast majority of people here probably have not heard this. Maybe you've experienced it, but it's not something that we're classically taught because we're always told fight or flight are the two ways that humans respond to threats. And I'm guessing, too, not knowing everyone's history, but those people that know of the other two means of response have probably been through some threats, some trauma in their life, and they've had to analyze and they've had to think about it. And that's where you realize, in fact, you're familiar with all four. Today I want to talk about the four ways that we respond to threats and how God talks about it, actually show examples in which Christ responded to conflict or threats using all four of these across the scripture, and what we should do about that knowledge. First, let me read this because it's a very nice encapsulation of the whole topic. They call it, sometimes you'll hear me say trauma response, sometimes you'll hear me say threat, sometimes you'll hear me say conflict. What it is you've got two people that are entering into a situation, and at least one of them perceives a risk, a threat, an insecurity, something. And it's how does that person respond to the situation coming from the other people? So threat response. A trauma or threat response happens naturally. When your body recognizes a threat, your brain and autonomic nervous system react quickly, releasing hormones like cortisol and adrenaline. These hormones trigger physical changes that help prepare you to handle a threat, whether it involves actual physical or emotional danger or even perceived harm. So it could be social. It doesn't have to be a bear attacking. You might, for example, and these are examples of each of these, argue with a coworker treating you unfairly. That's a fight response. Flee from the path of a car running a red light. That's a flight response. We're familiar with that. Freeze when you hear an unexpected noise in the dark. That's a freeze response. And keep quiet about how you really feel to avoid starting a fight. That's the fawn response. I have an affinity for the fawn response. I'll explain it in a minute. But that's my natural go-to response in a stress situation. It's also possible to have an overactive trauma response. In a nutshell, this means day-to-day occurrences and events most people don't find threatening can trigger your go-to stress response, whether that's fight, flight, freeze, fawn, or any combination of those. And overactive trauma responses are pretty common among survivors of trauma. No surprise. If you've been repeatedly stressed in a situation, you're triggered easier and you go into your reaction mode more quickly. Particularly those who experience long-term abuse or neglect. In fact, an overactive trauma response, getting stuck in fight, flight, freeze, or fawn, may happen as part of post-traumatic stress disorder or complex post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, let's talk about for a minute what each of these four are, because they're actually quite common. And after we go through this, I'll show you examples of Christ using each one of these stress or threat responses in a biblical perfect way. Now, he's different, and we'll talk about why he's different from the rest of us, but it's important to see that he utilizes these responses just like we would. The two most common ones that we're familiar with are fight and flight. While fight often refers to actual physical or verbal aggression, it can encompass any action that you take to stand up to a threat or negate it, like shouting at a friend when they accidentally mention something you wanted them to keep private, spreading a rumor about a coworker who criticized your work. I'm not arguing that these are good things to do, they're just using these as examples, and refusing to speak with your partner for a week when they lose your favorite sunglasses. I honestly don't know where these people come up with these things. They've got other issues they need to deal with. But the point being, It is a push back to the stress situation. Flight, which we're familiar with, a flight response, in short, is characterized by the desire to escape or deny pain, emotional turmoil, and other distress. And flight can be more subtle than fight. Flight might take a literal form, staying longer hours at school or a friend's house, or wandering the neighborhood when you want to avoid a situation that's difficult at home. Or a more figurative one, throwing yourself into your studies to occupy yourself, creating endless plans for escape, or drowning out arguments with music. So in this case, they're a metaphorical flight, but it's still an avoidance of the stress or threat. As an adult, you might continue to flee challenging or difficult situations by working towards perfection in all aspects of your life so no one can criticize or challenge you, ending relationships when you feel threatened before the other person can break up with you, and avoiding conflict or any situation that brings up difficult or painful emotions. And one that I think is very common in our society today, using work, hobbies, or even alcohol and substances to fend off feelings of fear, anxiety, or panic. Right? You look at the world we're in, and you think about the fact that these are natural responses that God wired into our brains to deal with stress, and you think of how stressful our world is, it's inevitable that humans will be turning to these stress responses, these threat responses, on a constant basis. So it's important for us to understand them and understand how we react and how others might be reacting to stress. Now let's talk about the two additional ones, freeze and fawn. Freezing is defined as a response that serves as a stalling tactic. Your brain presses the pause button and remains hypervigilant, waiting and watching carefully until it can determine whether fleeing or fighting or even fawning offers a better route to safety. It also acts like a means of disappearing in order to reduce the likelihood of a conflict. Long-term freeze response can come to resemble a mask that you use to protect yourself when you can't identify any means of fighting back or escaping. Behind the mask, you might use fantasy or imagination to escape day-to-day distress, prefer solitude and avoid close relationships, hide emotions and feelings, and physically detach from the world through sleep or by staying in your room or house. Again, you see this as we look around in the world, people that are suffering, people that are in chronic stress situations that are employing these exact response mechanisms. They're trying to figure out how to get out of the stress situation, and this is the method they use. Now, fawning, you escape harm by learning to please the person threatening you and keep them happy. I told you this is my favorite of the four threat responses, and I'm disappointed that I didn't know this years ago because it's a combination of personality, environment, trying things and figuring out what works for you may not work for someone else, that leads us to have a natural threat response. I, growing up, again, there's nothing wrong with any one of these, found that the fawning mechanism was the most useful for me. And it became something that I only recently realized I've deployed across my whole career, my personal lifestyle, and a number of other things. But as we will see, when you continually deploy a specific threat response, the world adapts to the way you behave, and they start to react to that. They expect that from you. That's the norm for your personality. And because of that, it changes the dynamic with people around you. Not knowing that that's what I was doing became very problematic in my life. Now, in fawning, again, you're escaping harm by learning to appease or keep the other party happy. This might involve ignoring your own needs to take care of a parent, making yourself as useful and as helpful as possible, neglecting or failing to develop your own self-identity, offering praise and admiration even when they criticize you, agreeing to whatever your partner asks of you, even if you'd rather not, constantly praising a manager in hopes of avoiding criticism or negative feedback, feel as if you know very little about what you actually like or enjoy, avoid sharing your own thoughts or feelings in close relationships for fear of making others angry, and having few if any boundaries in your own needs. Personally, that's what I learned I was doing. By always having a fawn response, I effectively had very weak boundaries. I didn't stand up for what I believed in. I appeased others and I compromised in order to make the situation less stressful, less threatening. And what it did was it taught others that they could push my boundaries and they could just keep pushing and pushing and pushing until they got what they want, right? But I had trained the world, if you will, because I was a constant fawner to do that. Now, that's a definition and a description of each of these. And a threat response is absolutely necessary. There's nothing wrong with it. When we're in a threat situation, we as humans need to assess it quickly, almost automatically, and respond. And we all have automatic responses. Anybody that thinks they don't is in denial. But that doesn't mean the one that you grew up learning or the one that you're most practiced at is the best. In fact, there's a number of scriptures, and we're going to turn to a fair number of them. There's a number of scriptures that talk to us about how should you deal with a threat response. First, let's turn to James 1:19. And I'm not going to have time to go through all these, but I'll give you some ways that you can link through the Bible and see the numerous scriptures that talk about how do we respond to a threat situation. James 1, verse 19. Therefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. For the wrath of man does not work out the righteousness of God. And I'm not reading this scripture as saying, see, this is proof that the fight instinct is wrong. I want to be very clear on this, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually read scriptures that if you try to force them into a universal law, will be contradictory. And that's not what's intended here. What it's saying is the human nature, that natural aggressive response to a threat, does not work godly righteousness. God says his righteousness comes from swift to hearing, slow to speaking, and slow to anger. Right? Now that would imply a favoritism towards freezing. Hold back, read the situation, don't respond. Proverbs 15, and a number, no surprise, of the scriptures that I have here and the wisdom that comes about when we start to understand and try to actively choose our response to threat come out of Proverbs, because it's the book of wisdom. Proverbs 15, verse 1. A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. What are they saying? Fawning. A fawn response is, let me calm the situation down. Let me use diplomacy. Let me de-escalate things, right? Proverbs 16 as well, one chapter over. Proverbs 16, verse 14 says, a king's wrath is a messenger of death, but the wise will appease it. Again, one vote in favor of fawning. You don't fight the king. You probably can't flee the king when there's a threat reaction. So your best bet is to maybe freeze, but to definitely fawn and calm the situation down. But I'll give you a counterexample. And this one may sound non-intuitive to someone that is a flight or fawn person, but again, it's biblical. Proverbs 20, verse 3. Says, it is to one's honor to avoid strife, but every fool is quick to quarrel. Sorry, I was looking for another one, but that one's still valid too. Here in this case, it's praising flight. It's saying, avoid the quarrel. Get out of the situation. Leave the situation that leads to conflict, right? Now, there are different responses that work better in different situations. The Bible gives us this, probably the most classic, anyone that's thinking about this. In fact, this was the first verse that came to my head when I started thinking about this topic, is over in Proverbs 26, verse 4 to 5. And it's interesting, when you go and research this online, you come across a lot of people that use this scripture as proof that the Bible contradicts itself. Christianity can't be right because you've got two verses back to back that disagree with each other. Therefore, throw the whole Bible out. What they're missing is, every one of these threat responses has a time and a place where it should be acted on. There's a wisdom to each one of these. God made them, and Christ actually used them. Proverbs 26, verse 4, do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you yourself will be like him. That's a flight situation. Could be a fawn situation, but it's, or maybe a freeze. Depends on the situation, but they're saying back down. When a fool is saying something dumb, don't respond. Back away. Yet verse 5 says, answer a fool according to his folly, or he will be wise in his own eyes. That's more of a fight situation. And again, I didn't pick the terms. They prefer the alliteration. But it's that push back. Don't let him get away with that. Don't let them push the boundaries in this stress situation, this conflict. Stop them. So here you have in two verses, one is saying there's a time for flight, and there is a time for fight. Proverbs 21:14, again, so much here in Proverbs. Proverbs 21:14 says, a gift given in secret soothes anger, right? So here you have a fawning situation, and a bribe concealed in the cloak pacifies great wrath. I'm not standing up here telling you guys to bribe people. That's not what the point is here. The point is there is a time to appease someone, to de-escalate, and to stand down. In Proverbs 15:18, you don't need to turn there, I'll read it to you. It says, a hot-tempered person stirs up conflict. Again, when human anger is involved, the stress reaction is not good. You cannot have a proper godly reaction to a trauma or a threat situation when we let our human emotions lead us. But the one who is patient calms a quarrel. This tends to imply more of a freeze situation. Just let it simmer down. Let it simmer down. Let it be okay. Back off. Don't engage. Now, I found it interesting. I had never equated these two, but it dawned on me. When we talk about the stages of grief, probably most people have heard the five stages of grief, right? You go through denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and finally acceptance. If you stop and think about what grief is a threat response to an immediate and catastrophic loss. You have had something taken away from you. It could be the death of a loved one. It could be the loss of a job, whatever it is. And you now have to deal with that threat. And you go through a wave of human emotions. But if you stop and think about what each of those phases of grief are, they're just other words for the four threat responses. Denial is effectively flight. Let me remove myself from the situation. It doesn't exist. I'm far away. Anger is a fight situation. I'm going to take it on. I have to deal with this threat. I'm going to face it head on. Bargaining is a form of fawning. It's saying, well, if I can do this, I can appease the situation, and it won't be as big of a threat. The loss won't be as bad. Maybe I can get out of this somehow. And depression is the freezing. You're putting on a mask, and you're shutting down. You're not going to respond to it. Acceptance, the fifth stage, is saying, this threat has happened. The change has taken place. The loss has happened. I can't do anything about it, but I have to move forward. So again, even in grief, we've been trained that there are four responses to threats. Now, I told you that Christ actually responded with each of these. So I want to give you examples of times when Christ used fight, flight, less gain. Okay, I love them. When Christ used fight, flight, fawn, and freeze. The difference I have to point out here is when you and I do it, we're typically doing it as an unconscious reaction. Maybe if we're really well practiced, we've taken 2 seconds and we figured out what the appropriate reaction to the stress is. But we're still acting out of emotion. We're acting out of adrenaline. We're acting out of a chemical change, doing our best to steer it. Christ was not. We know he was perfect. We know he was guided by God's Spirit. And in one case I'm going to read, he actually inspired humans to write hundreds of years before he responded this way, how he would respond. So you have to know that his threat responses were perfect, intentional, calculated, at levels we can't understand. So my intent here is not to say that Christ flew off the handle and reacted differently. My intent is to show that each one of these threat responses is legitimate, and there is a time and a place for it to be applied, as Christ did. So let's look first at fight, because you might not think of that one. But Christ fought back. Turn over to Matthew 21, a very famous scene that surprises some people, but on his second return, it will probably make a lot more sense. Here we have the situation with Jesus and the money changers in the temple. In Jesus, Matthew 21, verse 12, and Jesus went into the temple of God and cast out all those who sold and bought in the temple, and overthrew the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he said to them, it is written, my house shall be called the house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. He didn't appease them. He didn't ignore them. He didn't walk away. He said, no, This is not acceptable. I'm pushing back on this threat. It's not allowed. But he continues on, and this was interesting as well, in verse 15. And when the chief priests and scribes saw the wonderful things which he did, and the children crying in the temple and saying, Hosanna to the Son of David, they were angry. Again, the chief priests were threatened by Christ. And they said to him, Do you hear what these say? And Jesus said to them, Yes. Have you never read, out of the mouth of babes and sucklings, you have perfected praise? So again, you saw a physical pushback from Christ, where he turned over the money changers' tables. But you also saw a verbal pushback where he said, Yes, you're trying to criticize what these people are saying about me, but they're doing the right thing. You're in the wrong. It was another example of him pushing back, effectively fighting back in his threat response, and saying, No, I don't accept it. Now, the second one, this is interesting because I said, you will see a mixture of threat responses. You don't always see just one threat response in one way. Turn over to John 8, verse 6. And you'll see Christ here mixing a combination of freezing and fighting. Again, perfectly balanced, perfectly appropriate, led to the outcome he was looking for. This is the situation where some people brought a woman that had been caught in adultery. And they're like, hey, the Bible says you've got to stone her. You remember this scene? And they said, what should we do? And they're trying to accuse Christ in this situation. So picking up the story in verse 6, they said this, tempting him so that they might have reason to accuse him. But bending down, Jesus wrote on the ground with his finger, not appearing to hear. So he knew what they'd said. But he acted like he hadn't heard the situation. This is a classic example of, again, I'm not implying that he did this emotionally, we do, freezing. He was ignoring the threat. He wasn't taking it on. He wasn't running away, and he wasn't trying to de-escalate. He was letting the threat pass over. But as they continued to ask him, he lifted himself up, and he said to them, He who is without sin among you, let him cast the first stone at her. That's a fight response. He's standing up saying, you're not pushing anymore. I'm not backing off. We're going to go forward. Put your money where your mouth is. You throw the first stone. And there's lots of analysis as to what he was writing on the ground. And then again, bending down, he wrote on the ground, and he went back into freeze mode. And we know what happened. One by one, their guilt convicted them, and they walked off, and there wasn't anyone left. So in essence, he de-escalated the threat situation by using a combination of both freezing and fighting, again, perfectly. Now, let's look at an example where he uses flight. And these are, they always struck me as odd, given the power of Christ and his wisdom, but he knew the perfect timing. So go over to John 7, one chapter back. We'll see in verse 9. This is a situation where it was time to go up to the festival. And I'll go back to verse 8. This is Christ speaking to his disciples. You go to the festival. I'm not going up to this festival because my time has not yet fully come. Knowing that if he went to the feast, that he would be attacked and it wasn't time yet for events to play out. And after he said this, he stayed in Galilee. Verse 10 always struck me as interesting. However, after his brothers had left for the festival, he also went, not publicly, but in secret. So he went up to the feast, but he did not want it to be known. It was a situation where metaphorically he was in flight. He wasn't confronting them. He wasn't de-escalating them, right? He was coming in under the radar in a way that they wouldn't be noticed. You might call it freeze as well. But the point was it was non-confrontational. You have another situation over in Luke 4, and we don't need to turn there because it was a minor description, but Luke 4, verses 28 through 30. All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. Christ was speaking in the temple. And they got up, drove him out of the town, and took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built in order to throw him off the cliff. So you had a mob situation where he was about to get killed. But he walked right through the crowd and went on his way. The implication, again, was not that he forced back. He didn't de-escalate the situation by fawning. He just fled the situation. Did not engage. Now let's look at an example where he froze. A combination again of freezing and fawning. The story of him with Pontius Pilate. We begin over in Matthew 27, verse 11. You probably know it. Again, it's an unusual response for someone that spoke so boldly in the synagogues weekly, right? But he had mapped this out probably since the beginning of time, how this would play out. And so he gave the perfect response to this threat situation. Matthew 27, verse 11 says, "Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' And you have said so,' Jesus replied." So he was de-escalating the situation. He could have stood on his full authority. He could have done a number of things to get out of the situation, but he didn't. He just said, "Those are your words. They stand." It was a de-escalation maneuver. Then in verse 12, continuing, "When he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer." Here's a situation where he's freezing. He doesn't even bother to respond to them. Then Pilate asked him, "Don't you hear the testimony they're bringing against you?" But Jesus made no reply, not even to a single charge, to the great amazement of the governor. Here you have a full display of the freeze response. He wasn't going to re-engage. He wasn't going to do anything. He just shut down. Again, not as you or I would do emotionally, but in a perfectly planned way. Now, he was prophesied, as I said, which means he inspired the writers, in this case Isaiah, to speak about him hundreds of years before this event happened. So we know that his response was calculated and planned. Isaiah 53:7 is one of those prophecies. "He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth." Talking about the process of him being sacrificed. And the active choice he made not to respond in the full authority and power that he had, but to respond in the way that was as he and God had planned it, that was perfect for events to play out as they should. In that case, freezing was the perfect threat response. Finally, let's go to fawning, because you don't see this often, but it does come up. There's a very brief story that I've got questions, honestly, about. Over in Matthew 8, verse 31. All right? And this is a situation where there were, I believe, two men that had been possessed for a long time by demons, very strong demons, and everyone around them had tried to subdue them but couldn't. And Christ comes along, and I won't go through all the details, but the demons recognized him and said, "Have you come to torment us early?" And we're picking up the story in verse 31, Matthew 8. The demons begged Jesus, "If you drive us out, send us into the herd of pigs." He had every right to do anything with the demons. They had to submit to him, right? He could have fought them. He could have done anything. But in this case, he said to them, "Go." So they came out and went into the pigs, and the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and died in the water. And I don't imagine that that killed the demons. I don't imagine that it did anything on a spiritual plane. But it was interesting that he chose to allow them to have that exit strategy, right? That was an appeasement at some level. And again, I'm not reading into anything. But it was a conscious choice by Christ. It wasn't made in a short moment. He knew exactly what he was doing. But he de-escalated the situation, right? There's an example of fawning. There's another one that's a little bit lengthier over in Matthew 12. A situation where Matthew 12, it's a situation where there's a man with a shriveled hand, and Jesus chooses to heal him on the Sabbath day, much to the consternation of the Pharisees. So picking up Matthew 12, verse 10, "And a man with a shriveled hand was there looking for a reason to bring charges against Jesus. They asked him, 'Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?'" So again, here's your threat. You've got these Pharisees trying to trip up Jesus. "And Jesus said to them, 'If any of you has a sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will you not take hold of it and lift it out?'" See what he's doing here? He could have again quoted scriptures. He could have done a lot of things. But instead he chose to de-escalate the situation by tapping into a human emotion that he knew they had. Every one of you would have helped your sheep if it was in a trap situation on the Sabbath. Have compassion. This is a person that has been trapped by physical ailment. "How much more valuable is a person than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." He didn't flee the situation. He didn't freeze. He didn't fight back. He could have been much more authoritative. He de-escalated. This is a situation where he used fawning in this reaction to get the word that he needed out. Then he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." So he stretched it out, and it was completely restored, just as sound as the other. But the Pharisees went out and plotted how they might kill Jesus. It's important to note here, he didn't stop the threat, right? His fawning response got him through that. It taught us an important moral lesson about the Sabbath. But it didn't change the hearts of the Pharisees, right? Our threat responses rarely solve the underlying cause of the threat. What they do is they get us through the moment. They get us through the situation, and they let us go to the next threat, unfortunately. Now, seeing that Christ himself used all four threat responses, it should be clear that we will end up using all four threat responses in our life and as we navigate the inevitable conflicts that happen to us. I'm going to give you three proverbs that are a little bit deeper that need to be unpacked when you think about threat responses. And then we'll talk about what does all this have to do with us. Proverbs 28:25, "The greedy stir up conflict, but those who trust in the Lord will prosper." Think about that from a threat response. The greedy are trying to accomplish something, so they use the fight. Those that trust in God are the ones that prosper. Our threat responses should tie back to our faith and belief in God. Proverbs 28:23, "Whoever rebukes a person will in the end gain favor rather than one who has a flattering tongue." It's telling us here sometimes it's important to fight in a threat situation. Just because somebody comes up and says something that's uncomfortable or incorrect doesn't mean we should back off and compromise or fawn. There's a time when we need to push through that stress conflict. Some people are really good at it. There are members of my family that are really good at the fight side of it. I tend to be a fawner. And it's educational to see how each person responds to that situation out of their strength. And lastly, Proverbs 21:9. This always cracked me up as a kid. Thankfully, I've never had to apply it, but I knew it was out there. Proverbs 21:9. "Better to live on the corner of a roof than share a house with a quarrelsome wife." And the version I had was always to live in a broad house with an angry wife. So you can have lots of square footage, but if she's angry, you've got a problem. So just flee the situation, right? So that's a flight. So what does this have to do with us? There's some very important lessons that I think we tend to gloss over as humans, that I think we tend to gloss over as a community as well. First of all, realize that threat response is autonomic. All of us respond to it however we respond. We could probably break into four groups, and if we really dug into it, we'd find out that a quarter of us respond naturally with flight, a quarter respond with fight, a quarter with freezing, and a quarter with fawning. And that's normal and natural, and it happens. What's important is we should not judge others on their threat response. When you see somebody responding to a threat, you don't know what traumas they've been through. You don't know how they were raised. You don't know what coping mechanisms they came up with to survive to this point. And if we project onto them and say, "Well, if I was in that situation, I would have responded this way. They didn't, therefore, fill in the blank." We have done a massive disservice. Before you read any of these situations with Christ, I doubt that we would have taken a quiz and said, "This is how Christ is going to respond in this situation." He responded perfectly, and yet we don't know how he would respond until after we read it. We have the benefit of knowing his response. We don't have the benefit of knowing the correct response when somebody else is going through threat. So it's very, very, very important that we not judge other people and how they respond to threats. Secondly, more importantly, well, maybe not more importantly, more personally, we have to know ourselves. We need to figure out what our natural threat response is, because you have one. You have a go-to. If you don't believe it, ask the people around you that know you. They'll tell you how you react most times when there's conflict. And this was the important piece for me. When you understand what your natural threat response is, start to think about what that does to the environment you live in. I said my natural threat response is fawning. When I understood a few months ago that fawning was a thing, I started looking at my life, the choices that I had made, and I realized that when I fawned, when I placated or de-escalated a threat situation, I inevitably ended up, and this is just me personally, I inevitably ended up moving boundaries, boundaries that I should not have moved. And what it taught the people around me was, when you push on Kirk, you can get more of what you want, right? Wasn't proper, wasn't right, but that's what I've been doing for 50 years. I taught people to do that. I don't know what your threat responses are, but if you have a pattern of responding in a certain way, you have taught people around you, this is how I will behave, and they will act accordingly. It's just natural, right? So if your natural go-to is a fight response every time there's conflict, people around you have adapted and learned, oh, okay, I can either use that to my advantage, or I'll avoid them, or whatever it is, right? We've taught people how to respond to us. So it's really important that each of us understand what our natural threat response is so that we can understand why people around us treat us the way they do. Finally, the real purpose of all this is apply the wisdom that is encoded in our Bible, the wisdom of the examples Christ gave us, the wisdom in Proverbs, the wisdom in Psalms, it's scattered throughout, that tells us this is how you should react to inevitable conflict that will come in our life. And when we do, we can start to act more like Christ, we can start to glorify God our Father, and we can start to navigate this world in a proactive way that helps us to deal with the inevitable conflicts that will come in our life.